Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now it's time for our gathering, and this week I'm joined by Fergus O'Dowd, Fine Gael TD for Louth and Chair of the Joint Committee on the Implementation of the Good Friday Agreement. Breed Smith is here, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South Central. Ellen Coyne, News Correspondent with the Irish Independent, and Patricia McBride, Columnist with the Irish News. I want to start with the cost of living. We had a text there from Damien who wants to know why fuel can't be capped at 1.30. We know that some people are paying €2 for diesel now a litre, but Fergus, there were senior citizens and students and workers marching to the Dáil this week over the cost of electricity and all of the other things, college fees, health, childcare costs. Now we have this diesel problem. The crisis is growing deeper by the week, I'm sure you'd agree.
It is, of course, and it's an internationally obvious to everybody with the war in the Ukraine, but clearly at home it's a huge issue. I paid over €2 this morning.
Did you?
I did, actually, for petrol. I was surprised at that, but obviously I had to go to that particular station because it was the one I had to go to. But it is a huge issue. Obviously,
But the last time we went to over €2, the government intervened.
Yes,
and there was the excise cut.
Yes, indeed. Now, that was that was an important intervention.
Yeah,
the 20 cents and the 12 cents, depending on the diesel or the petrol.
So if the government said we can't go to over €2.
Well, €2 is a trigger for everybody.
Yeah. And is it a trigger for government again?
Well, I would certainly be making the point that they have to look very seriously at all of this. Clearly, the budget is planned for October. But in the interim, you know, we have to help people. And obviously, clearly, we've done it already. Mm-hmm. People who are on the fuel allowance, 360,000 people, we made sure they got an additional €425 since January.
Yeah, so but you're not saying that there should be a cut in the excise on fuel.
Well, I think that whatever the government can do, it should do, it must do. Clearly, the question of the European Union is also key as well, because this is an energy crisis right across the European Union.
And if they should help us.
Well, I think I don't see why they shouldn't, particularly in terms of energy issues. Everybody is facing these costs, and it'll upset everybody's economy, along with the cost of living rises that are coming in mortgages and in everything else. Like it's food prices, food shortages. Yeah. I spoke to the IFA last week, and they were talking about significant food shortages in Europe. Mm-hmm. And we read about famines in other parts
because
of the world.
Because we had heard from government Breed up to now that nothing would happen until the budget, that the measures that had been taken, that was it. That's different.
Well, I think Fergal is singing a different tune to Leo and others who have said that they'd be looking at all these things in the budget. I do think they have to do more, absolutely have to do more, particularly on the basics, particularly on the fuel and the costs to the ordinary household of gas and electricity. There's also other things. I mean, the cost of living, and you described it very well, it covers a whole gambit of society and a whole load of different areas. There are other things they could do immediately with no cost to the state, like what we did during COVID, which put a ban on evictions, introduce rent controls, freeze all rents. You can't put up the rent anywhere. And that would help hugely a whole very vulnerable cohort to be able to handle it. And then on the question of energy, I think that when you look at it, all the energy companies and the fossil fuel industry have indicated and have shown that their profits are soaring. And there should be some government intervention, whether it's at a European level or at an Irish level, where they say to those who are profiteering from this that they have to be curbed and that the costs have to be kept down.
Ellen, what do you think the government should and can do now to address cost of living across the board?
Well, as you said, they set a precedent to intervene at €2, so I don't know how they wouldn't be able to at this point. And while everyone appreciates that obviously there are international global factors with this, I think the reason that this is so frustrating for people is because, as Breed says, this is kind of one thing on top of many, many things that are leaving people really frustrated and really anxious. And I know there's a lot of coverage during the week about the rental crisis as well. I had a look on DAF this morning for Dungarvan, where I'm from. There were zero properties to rent. There was over 140 Airbnbs available. And we have this domino effect now where, because of remote working, people from Dublin who are on higher salaries, who sold houses for a lot more money, are moving down the country. They're taking up the properties that are available. People, nurses, doctors, primary school teachers who were from towns like Dungarvan have to move further away, which means that when they can eventually afford to start a family, they have to pay extra for childcare because they they don't have those supports available. And I think this is going to be a real legacy problem, particularly for Fine Gael, because when you think of the generation that was in their kind of early mid-20s for marriage equality and repeal, I think there was a kind of naive assumption that they would have goodwill towards that party because of the measures that they were involved in, the kind of social justice measures. But now you're getting to a point where people are in this incredible situation where they either need to delay having a second child or put off ever having their first child because they can't afford to, despite the fact they might be a couple who have what most people would regard as a very good job. And I think that when you're getting to that point, you're looking at a real problem for that party, where you might have a huge cohort of what they might have considered to be potential voters who not only have no stake in Fine Gael, but feel like they've no stake in the state.
Yeah, it's a valid point, Fergus. And I put this to the Taoiseach earlier, earlier in the week. When you look at the legacy of Fine Gael, you have people like Senator John Cummins from your own party on a good salary saying that he would need to use a state scheme to buy a house.
Yeah. Well, it is very difficult for everybody. I acknowledge that.
But is that what you wanted for your party to leave behind when eventually you get to that point?
Well, I think the key point is that the number of new housing starts, for instance, in the last 12 months is over 34,000 homes. I think the key point is the first 3 months of this year, the number of houses that have been completed is 5,600, which is not enough, obviously, I acknowledge that. It's at pre-pandemic level. So there's a lot of things happening.
So give us more time. Patricia, you're shaking your head there.
I mean, it's every house is welcomed, but it's very, very slow. And the problem with all of these houses is the lack of affordable housing. Yeah. You know, young people, people who want to live in the cities can't afford to do it. So they're commuting long distances. You're putting huge strain on infrastructure when you're doing that, whether it's the road infrastructure and transport or on wastewater treatments, the sewerage systems, all of those things. It's just not there. The infrastructure isn't there. But one thing that we've learned in the last couple of years, the government really needs to take to heart, I believe. If you look at how government responded and society responded to COVID-19, and more recently, if you look at how we responded to the crisis in Ukraine, programmes were put in place very, very quickly that people could buy into across the board. We can do the same with the housing crisis. There are ways that, you can look at compulsory purchase orders for properties that are long-term vacant. You can implement a property tax on vacant properties that will encourage owners who have vacant properties to use them as rentals so that we can start to mitigate that. We can look at how, we can use other buildings and repurpose other buildings.
But how long have we had a housing crisis and that hasn't happened?
But what I'm saying is we should learn the lessons from these two most recent events of COVID and of the Ukraine crisis on how we can do things in this country when and if.
Just on that point, Louth County Council have dealt with the issue of vacant property. They actually got over 100 houses which were vacant or abandoned, put them in commission, families in them for less than 200,000 per house. I've been arguing that that should be a national policy, and they're talking about now appointing a former chief executive nationally to manage that. They're not doing it quickly enough, but it's what I believe in. Okay. The second point is a vacant property tax. I absolutely support 100%. And I think that will also drive the agenda to releasing properties that their keys are there and nobody's opening the door.
Reid, you spoke about freezing the rents, and we were having conversations about this again during the week on the programme, but somebody just got in touch to remind us that landlords are leaving the market, the rental sector in droves. Freezing rents might not be a good idea. And we know that that's happening with the smaller landlords who might be paying 52% tax because it's seen as a top-up to their income.
Well, I also argued that we should ban evictions. We did it during COVID, and I'm very sorry for private landlords who aren't able to keep up with the expenses and the costs and the loans that they have. But we do have a crisis on our hands, and if landlords are en masse leaving the market, then we do have to do something to slow down the amount of evictions. And a ban on evictions, albeit something temporary that we can look at again in 6 months' time, is needed now. There's loads of working families ending up in the homeless agency. And these are people with jobs.
What if you have a landlord who wants to sell a house that they have currently rented out, and that house then would be released into the market so a young couple could buy it? But you're saying there's a ban on eviction, so they can't.
Well, I think you see the conditions under which landlords can tell people, your time is up, I'm giving you notice now because I want to sell, I don't think they're fair. And they've been too liberal in order to allow landlords to say, I am selling this on, so you have to go, or I'm giving it over to a member of the family, or I'm refurbishing it. And we've had so many people come to us those who are being evicted on those grounds when they have lived and rented a home for 10, 12, 15 years and find themselves absolutely nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And as I say, they're working families who are ending up in homeless and emergency accommodation. It's very hard to be fair to everybody, but at the end of the day, we do have to protect the most vulnerable.
Ellen mentioned the short-term letting problem, and we saw that during the week when Brian O'Connell reported on it for us. 850 places to rent across the whole of Ireland. Yeah. And then if you look at, even just look at Kerry, there were 1,000 short-term rents, lets available, holiday lets. And this listener has just texted in to say the government needs to ban them altogether, the short-term lets. It's a huge problem at the root of the crisis. Now, I'm sure we can't do that because people will need places to stay for holidays and so on. But clearly, there are people who own properties that could be used for long-term letting who are saying, well, I can make more money out of the short-term lets. That needs to be addressed.
Well, when you're living in a rent pressure zone, I think that, you know, there should be a ban basically on short-term letting. Whether you can do that legally or not is a different question, but I would agree fully that any home in where there's a rent pressure zone, where there's a shortage of accommodation, people should be able to bid for that to live in with their family.
That's everywhere now. There's a shortage of accommodation.
No, I accept that, but it's not say if I go to, I'm not being rude, but somewhere like West Kerry where half the homes are empty, where I go anyway, my holidays occasionally, you know, nobody would probably ever go in there except on a holiday because the facilities aren't there. You know, but the key point
is working from home. Though I thought the aim was to put the legislation in place so that people could live in places like West Kerry.
I'm not disagreeing with the principle that Breed's enunciating. What I am saying is that where the key pressure is, where people are now today, if there's a property and you can't get it, if it's short-term letting, that's a significant disadvantage to anybody. Mm-hmm. The other point is that in fairness, I think I have to make this point that there is in a rent pressure zone the maximum rent increase is 2%. So if you're lucky enough to be in accommodation, the rent cannot increase by more than 2%. The difficulty is that new houses or houses which are vacant for more than 2 years coming on the market, they have increased, I think, by 9% this year. And we need to tackle that as well.
Did you see the report that Jim Power did about the rent pressure zones during the week?
He said
they're not working. He said that landlords are leaving the market because of rent rigidity and they're being replaced by the institutional landlords with new stock, higher rents.
Well, I would disagree to say that rent pressure zones are not working. They are, because I know before they came in my constituency office, people couldn't pay the rent. It was going up exponentially. Now they can pay, but it is a problem with new people coming on the market. So I think we have to address that. And I don't have a solution.
Do you think they're working, Ellen?
I think no. I think they're definitely well-intentioned and on paper a great idea. But I think that one of the big problems isn't brand new properties. It's when the tenancy ends because the landlord claims they're selling it. And then the person sees their apartment going up for way beyond. And I had the experience of living in a property that was in a rent pressure zone and having a landlord trying to illegally raise it, actually sending them articles I had written myself about the law. And that was around the time I vividly remember a Fine Gael minister was on air talking about how co-living was like a little kind of boutique hotel, and I was very conscious that one of these co-living arrangements that was selling basically like little cubicles for a grand was being built near my apartment, and I had a real anxiety that was going to cause the rent to go up. So I could see that they weren't working and people can find ways around them. I know there's problems with it, but I think for a long time housing activists have been calling for some sort of register where you could check what the rent was in your property when you moved in, the last rent, to make sure that the increase hadn't gone beyond what was actually legally permissible.
Sure. I think in fairness, your point, the rent pressure zone, the RTB residential tenants, so they will tell you what the rent is. And if I leave it, as I understand it, and I appreciate you have had a different experience, if I leave a place today, if it's going to be continuously rented, the landlord cannot increase that rent greater than 2%. Unless it's vacant for 2 years or it's a brand new property, if it's in a rent pressure zone.
I want to move on because the Taoiseach Micheál Martin's in Belfast today for meetings on the impasse at Stormont and the issues around the Northern Ireland Protocol. And we're joined on the line now, if you want to just put your headphones on, to hear Peter Somerton, Managing Director of McCullough Transport and Freight, which has offices in Northern Ireland, in the Republic and operations in Britain. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you for joining us on the programme. Is the protocol a problem for you? Is it causing you difficulty?
Yes, Claire, I think that in order to explain this, I have to point out that this is about logistics for McCullough Ireland. It's not about politics. There's plenty of commentary about that already. And there's there's confused messages between exporters and importers because some people win, some people lose. But the haulage community needs to see everything in the round because we actually need a vibrant market between Britain and Ireland, quite simply to keep trailers moving east-west and then coming back west-east again to keep the supply chain running for Ireland's exporters as well.
Okay, and the supply chain is not smooth at the moment. Is that what you're saying?
No. What I would say is that whenever we look at what has happened post-Brexit, we're seeing north-south is almost the same as pre-Brexit.
Okay.
The only real difference there is that it's more difficult for northern producers to use Port of Dublin to access GB markets because of different requirements for export from Belfast and Dublin. So there's a de facto tight border for those sort of movements. North-south is the same. Ireland, the GB, is the same with some bureaucracy because the British have not put in any real controls on imports to Britain. GB to Ireland is where it becomes fascinating because they're full third country to EU controls. And we've done quite a lot of modelling around this with the Northern Ireland Protocol because the Northern Ireland Protocol, the Northern Ireland supply chain is much more integrated into the GB market than the Republic of Ireland ever was. In fact, Northern Ireland just needs to be seen as like another province of GB to understand how the supply chain actually works. You know, I mentioned names like Sainsbury, Asda. You can see in terms of the retail, and I'll focus on retail for a second, just to show how integrated Northern Ireland actually is into the GB chain because it's serviced from distribution centres in England, Scotland and Wales directly into those supermarkets. Mm-hmm. So what does the protocol actually do is the question that most people ask. Well, what the protocol actually does is it creates a third country status for GB, which means that products moving between Britain and Northern Ireland are subject to those full checks now and controls and the documentation beforehand. That's a massive level of bureaucracy because in a regional economy, in that integrated economy, the product mix is very different than moving internationally. It prohibits things like chilled meats from coming across. It prohibits third country goods moving into Britain and then on to Northern Ireland, which is some of the most cost-effective products in the supermarkets.
Yeah.
It creates excessive bureaucracy cost. And on top of all that, there's an extremely low failure rate in the checks, something like 0.087. The UK government's spending hundreds of millions of pounds mitigating this. And there's TSS, 200 million. The movement assistance scheme cost 330,000 in the first 20 days.
Peter, will you stay with us because I want to get some reaction from the studio to what you've just been saying. Patricia?
Yeah, no doubt there are problems with the protocol and they do need to be addressed. And, you know, we're seeing the goodwill that has taken place between the EU and the British government in the past. If you look at issues around particularly around medicines and things like that. So there are issues that can be dealt with through, you know, mitigations and a negotiation process. But there's something else we need to bear in mind. Part of the problem here is that the British government has done nothing during the grace periods to put in place the processes that needed to be put in place.
Hundreds of millions, in order, Peter said.
Well, I mean, it's not enough, obviously. I mean, they've done very, very little. They have, you know, there were issues around checks in Larne and issues around checks in various ports that were withdrawn and then brought back in. You know, we need to look at a solution that is going to help all of business and industry. The fact that Peter is saying that there are no checks when you're going, you know, from west to east when you're going into Britain is quite concerning. You know, why would there not be if this is a third country situation? So the political situation right now is that we need to get some resolution, a soft landing ground where everybody can agree in terms of working out.
So you're saying GB hasn't worked hard enough on the solutions?
Yes.
Peter, what do you say to that?
What I would say to that is I don't want to get drawn into the politics of it. There's no checks west to east because it's perceived by the UK that there is no real threat in terms of food security for products coming from Ireland to Britain. And that's borne out whenever we look at the actual result of the checks that do happen in Belfast and Larne. Because the failure rate, and I can reference Stormont documents in this, is actually 0.087% of goods being returned, and they're returned for documentary purposes. In other words, there's hundreds of millions of pounds being spent and a supply chain being stifled. And if you risk assessed it, the risk assessment that would actually say this is incredibly safe. That's why we were able to function through the whole of the last 25 years together. This is a very low-risk supply chain. It's very important people understand how these costs actually build for business. And I can go into that next, but if you want me to keep going
I want to bring in some more of our panel here now. Fergus, you're listening there to somebody who's on the coal face of this, dealing with the problems that it brings. Do you accept that it needs to change so that people like Peter can do their business?
And that's why the Taoiseach is there, and that's why, excuse me, Sammy Coven is meeting Liz Truss, I think, next Wednesday to talk about this issue. Like, the reality is, at the end of the day, we want a vibrant, peaceful Ireland, and we want business to succeed, not to be hammered by issues like this. So I think the answer is negotiate, talk, find a solution. I think it's very, very clear. Simon Coveney said again and again and again, and the T-shirt, there are landing zones. Let's work together. Let's find a solution. Let's be practical and let's work together. And the problem is the British government has basically refused to engage in a significant way.
At this stage, where the goodwill is at between the two governments?
Well, I think we still got to accept, like, Britain was our best friend for many, many years.
But
we still have huge commitments to each other in terms of families and businesses, just like we're talking now. And I think common sense must prevail, and I would hope that common sense, and the other point is that if everything was to break down and if there was a war between the European Union and the UK, America is not going to do a deal with the UK. Costs are going to go up in Britain. They have inflation, they have all these other problems, so everything would indicate to me that they must engage.
Breed, your party supported Brexit, didn't it, initially?
We were for a critique of the European Union on the basis of its failure to look after.
Did you foresee any of this happening, though?
No, we didn't. We didn't campaign for Brexit. We didn't give out a single leaflet or put up a single poster. But we did critique the whole idea that the European Union was a perfect model and looked after everybody equally, particularly on things like migrant rights and workers' rights. However, I think Peter started out by saying there that this is a logistics issue, but it has become a political issue because the DUP and the Tory party made it so, particularly in the immediate aftermath of the election and the refusal of the DUP to share power. So I think this is, I hear what he's saying. I'm no expert on trade and how it all works, but there clearly is a problem and there must be a logistic solution to it. But the bottom line, I think, needs to be for the European Union to honour their commitment to us that there will be no hard border on the island of Ireland.
And do you feel that we're moving to a place where perhaps that might become an issue again?
Well, it's always a danger, isn't it? It's always a danger. And that,
you know,
Michel Barnier stood in front of us in the Dáil and guaranteed us at least three times there will be no hard border on the island of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be the bottom line.
Yeah, because one potential solution is that we have this green channel where the goods are coming in from GB into Northern Ireland. Yeah. They're not going any further, but they're going to have to be checked, when they're coming over the border.
Yeah, that is a logistics issue. It's not a political issue. The political issue that we're facing right now...
But you can't put a logistical border on the island of Ireland and not expect it to be political. That's what's going to happen inevitably.
Well, I mean, I think that there has to be some sort of way of landing somewhere where everybody can live with it. But what you have is 365,000 unionist voters essentially dictating British government policy, for a nation of over 67 million. And you can't have that. That's not sustainable. You have a British government that has negotiated an international treaty and is now threatening to legislate to unilaterally resile from elements of that treaty. But it doesn't even seem to know what it's doing, because when Liz Truss got on her feet in Westminster earlier this week, she said, we're going to tell you about the rest of the things we plan on doing next week and the week after that. So they haven't even got a plan. Mm-hmm. It's evident that they haven't even got a plan. And it's quite frightening observing once again the DUP trusting Boris Johnson to deliver.
All right, we'll leave that one there. Peter Somerton, thank you for joining us on the line. Fergus, the government lost two TDs. Were you disappointed this week? Two Green Party TDs?
Of course I was disappointed. It was something I wish hadn't happened. I suppose the benefit that the fact that the government has insisted that they're going ahead with maternity hospital is very good news for all the potential potential models in Ireland that are going to use it. The question is, if the planning permission is there since 2017, we're 5 years into that now. If we change to a different site, we have to get an acute tertiary hospital we can put it on. You're talking about 10, 15 years delay. So the government had no choice. There's absolutely legal guarantees as regards the what will happen there.
Ellen, did you feel the government had no choice?
I know that people were kind of painting the last couple of weeks as like a farce and a little bit useless. And I think that that is unfairly focusing on the politics of it. I think that one of the most unfortunate things about this was that Holles Street and equally St. Vincent's didn't come out soon enough to explain themselves what was happening with this hospital and try to put aside some of the fears. And from my understanding, that was an issue of them not being able to speak until the shares were transferred and the deal was done. So I think that the last 2 weeks were very useful in terms of actually hearing from the experts, from the doctors themselves. If we remember from Repeal, there was a lot of stock put in listening to and trusting doctors. And I thought it was unusual that that ethos was kind of abandoned this time around from some of the same people who were so intrinsic to that campaign. So I think that for that purpose, the last 2 weeks were useful. But I think that just because this has moved off the cabinet table and off the headlines, I think for a lot of people, it's not resolved. Some people obviously have issues with, you know, it not being built on public land. We don't need to get into that. But I think my concern is that there's a significant cohort of people out there who still believe that it's going to be built on, quote, religious land, which is not true, who still believe that St. Vincent's is kind of an outpost of the Vatican where you can't get contraception or termination of pregnancy, also not true. And I think that for those people, they will remember that and they will punish politicians. And I think of the three parties in government, the Greens are probably the ones to bear the brunt of that the most.
Breed, you do think the last 2 weeks were a farce, do you?
I think it was theatrics, yeah, definitely. And we started out actually by, you know, Stephen Donnelly saying, I hear you, I want to hear your concerns, I want to make changes. We, you know, we look at the wording around clinically appropriate and putting out carrots all the time. And then when we did have the witnesses in, and they were very useful and interesting investigations and discussions from both the St. Vincent's Healthcare Group and the National Maternity Hospital obstetricians and doctors. But at the end of the day, both those two groups said they were willing to look at either amending or removing the words clinically appropriate, and the Irish state was not. Now, what's really kind of bothered me about the whole thing is that after it was a done and dusted deal and there was a challenge in the Dáil, Micheál Martin said, this is the model of the future. This is the way to go. This is a perfect example of how we have to move forward with our healthcare. That means we're locked in, despite all the years of work around Sláinte Care, we're locked in to a fragmented and disjointed system of voluntary, charity, private, public healthcare. We will never have a national healthcare system in this country.
So you believe that chain wasn't broken with this hospital,
absolutely.
You think it'll never be broken?
Well, it certainly won't be broken on women's care and reproductive rights and maternity care, because we're locked into that for 300 years, or else we start paying nearly €1 million a year. We'll be locked into maternity care being on that model and reproductive rights being on that model for the next 300 years. About the future,
all right, we're running out of time.
Every mother in there will get whatever services that she requires from a medical perspective. There's no bishop on the board. There's no nun in the corridor. It's going to be, I believe, a centre of excellence, the centre that we need beside the tertiary hospital. If we're to start all over again, the difficulty with your argument is that we're back 15, 20 years.
Patricia McBride wants to say something really quickly.
If Elise was as good as ownership, then we wouldn't have a housing crisis.
Yeah. Can I just address that question of the delay? You see, this has been portrayed as if somehow people like me and people in the opposition were responsible for the delay.
The delay
resulted from a very complex argument and negotiations between the nuns, the Vatican, and St. Vincent's Healthcare Group. They delayed it. To start all over again, you don't face that delay if you build on public
land. But I'm talking about design, build, all that stuff.
We're out of time. Thank you all very much indeed. That's all for today. Thank you for listening. Today's programme was produced by the series producer Alistair McConnell, research by Kieran Dunn. Louise Kerr Ross is our broadcast coordinator. Padraig Carney was on sound. Have a lovely weekend. It's over to Shea Byrne.
You too, Claire, and all your